Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. Salon at 615 is recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out and hearing. I'm always so excited and inspired by a room full of people here to hear someone talk about a book. I'm especially excited when the book is mine, so thank you. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to talk about Wild tonight and read a couple little snippets from it and maybe a little bit from Tiny Beautiful Things as well. I'm mostly going to talk, when I go hear a writer talk about their book, I want to hear the story behind the story. How many of you have read Wild? Oh my goodness, thank you. So maybe the better question is, how many of you have not read Wild? Shame, yeah. I'm teasing. I'll try not to spoil anything for those of you who haven't read. The big spoiler is I survived. So many people have said to me, you know, I had to remind myself when I was reading the book, she didn't die because she wrote the book, right? You know, so I didn't die, but it was a journey really unlike any I've ever been on. Wild tells the story of my 1,100-mile hike on the Pacific Crest Trail. I did it in the summer of 1995, way back in the days, boys and girls, before the internet. Or rather, there was the internet, but only Al Gore was on it. And it really, you know, it's really kind of an important thing to think about when you think about me on that trail then, because it was a different world. You know, now it's still incredibly remote to go out and hike the PCT. You're still far away from civilization and oftentimes other people at all. But what a lot of hikers have in their back pocket now is an iPhone. And they're, you know, even I went hiking last summer on the PCT and I tweeted from the PCT. I'm on the PCT, tweet. And it's really strange where we can go online and read trail journals. People uploading their experiences by the day from the trail. And when I was out there, there was really none of that. A lot has been said about, how unprepared I was. I'll get into that a little bit more later. But one of the things was that I tried to research the trail more, but it wasn't, just at my fingertips. It wasn't like I could Google the PCT and read all those trail journals. I walked very much alone, and if you wanted to contact me, you had to write a letter and send it to the post office that you thought I might be at, at the next stop. And so there was a real profound solitude. I sought that solitude, and those of you who've read the book know, there's the hiking boot on the cover, which leads some people to think that the book is about hiking. And it is very much about hiking, but it's also about what brought me to the hike. And it's pretty important that the boot on the cover is a single boot, because it's an orphan boot. It's sort of a lost boot. I was very much like that when I set out on the PCT. The story really is about why I went on the hike and what I was coming to grips with on the hike. And that story began on March 18th, 1991, when my mom died quite suddenly of cancer. She was 45 years old, and I'm 44, so she was just a year older than I am now. And she got what she thought was a bad cold, and that wouldn't go away. And before we knew it, she was diagnosed with advanced stage lung cancer. And she died 7 weeks later. We were both seniors in college in Minnesota. I had grown up in northern Minnesota in rural Aiken County, which is about an hour and a half west of Duluth. I don't know if any of you know that territory or not, but it's cold, very cold and harsh and beautiful and remote. And we lived on 40 acres of land, my stepfather, mother, and brother and sister, and I didn't have indoor plumbing. My parents got a toilet when I was, 20, couple of years before my mom died. And we didn't have electricity or running water for a big chunk of my teenage years. And I didn't know any writers growing up. I grew up poor and working class. But I knew that I loved reading, and I loved books, and language did something to me that was unique, that nothing else did. That when I read great books or great poems or great short stories, I felt pierced by such a magnificent beauty that I just knew that I wanted to somehow be a person in the world who made other people feel that way with words. And so I didn't have this really real sense of how to become a writer, but I thought that probably it entailed going to college. And so I applied to college. I didn't know what you were supposed to do when you apply to college, so I just applied to one. And the way I chose it is I just lined up all these brochures and looked at the pictures on the front of the brochure. So if any of you work in marketing or advertising, it matters. Like, that is how I chose to apply to this one school I did. It was the picture with the kind of nicest looking building and the least number of weird looking people. So it was this Catholic private university called St. Thomas. And I applied, it was in St. Paul, Minnesota. I applied and they accepted me. And in their letter, you know, they were trying to woo me to come. They didn't know I didn't have any choice. And they said, your parents and grandparents can go to school for free if you come here. And my mom had always wanted to go to college, had not ever had that opportunity. She'd become pregnant with my older sister when she was 19 and married my father, and had then, you know, really had a very, you know, pretty rough sort of self-sacrificing number of years raising my brother and sister and I, mostly as a single mom. And she said, you know, I have always wanted to go to college when we read that letter. And my first thought was, no way in hell are you going with me. I mean, how many of you would have taken your mom to college? Just raise your hand if at 17 you would have enjoyed that. So I was just like, ha, 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 mom. But what happened is, over the next few weeks, that truer voice that lives in all of us really started saying, you know, speaking up and saying, well, you know, I was a teenager and I was, you know, it was really wanting to go off and be free of my mother in many ways, but I also really loved my mother and I really respected her, and I understood how much she'd sacrificed. I understand now more, but I understood even then. And so I said to her, okay, you know, I don't want to deny you this. You can come to college with me, but there's one rule, and that is if you encounter me on this tiny campus, you cannot show any glimmer of recognition or acknowledgement. Unless I acknowledge you, we are to be perfect strangers. And she agreed. And so we did. We both went full-time, and that freshman year, and our lives both changed. You know, just the world opened up before us. I started to meet people, my professors who were writers, and my mom, for the first time, got to see herself as smart. She went and she got straight A's, and she was like the world's best student, and loved it. And I was paying for my own college education, a combination of Pell Grants and loans and state aid and then like three or four jobs. And it was ridiculous for me to go to a private school. I couldn't afford it. So I told my mom after that, you know, first semester or so that I was going to transfer to a school I could afford. So I transferred, and she said, that's fine, I'll transfer too. And she did. We both transferred to the University of Minnesota. Thankfully, there's more than one campus. So she went to the Duluth campus about an hour and a half from our house, and I went in Minneapolis. And so we were college students together, and it was on the spring break of our senior year of college that she died. She died on the Monday of our spring break. And Friday was her funeral, and then the next Monday I went back to school. I had one quarter left. My mom had two classes left before she died. And I had 5 classes that I had to take. And I wanted just to quit school. But my mother said, please, you know, no matter what, just please do this. Just get this degree. It meant a lot to her. So I went back to school and just sort of tried to grieve my mom at the same time as being a functional person who had 2 jobs and was a full-time student. And I sort of held it together, and I was the person in my family who, you know, really took care of my mom when she was sick and organized all the things around the funeral and the death. And I was thinking in those early months after my mom died that I could replace my mom, you know, in our family. And I didn't know until she died how powerful she was. Like, there was this whole invisible, this whole thing that had been invisible to me when she was alive, that when she died was suddenly, you know, irreplaceable. I couldn't be the mother. I was this 22-year-old who had lost her mom. And so I grieved my mom in good ways in the beginning, and then some time passed, and I started, that grief, I just started to kind of fall apart. My family fell apart. My stepfather couldn't continue really being that parent he had been to me and my siblings, and we all sort of scattered in our grief. And for my part, what I did is I really started to self-destruct. I was married at the time. I had married really young, too young, but to somebody who was a good guy who I loved and who loved me. And I just did stuff. I couldn't sustain that relationship. I did things you're not supposed to do. I had sex with men and women and all kinds of things. Actually, just men and women. Kept it to the human race. I kept it. It would be called really wild if I had exceeded that bound. But no, I kept it. I kept. But it is, you know, destroying that one relationship that was good in my life. And one of the people I got involved with. So my ex-husband and I were living in Minneapolis at the time, and we broke up, you know, and which was a very tumultuous thing. And I went to Portland, Oregon, where I live now, kind of seeking escape from the drama of my life in Minnesota. And I, you know, really went and found more drama. I met this man who I became involved with, and he had just become involved with using heroin. And he said to me, "Do you want to try this?" And I said, sure. And, you know, the older me who wrote Wild could see so clearly that young woman that I was and what I was seeking in that moment. And, you know, I was seeking, I felt so alone in the world. I didn't have parents. My biological father was not in my life, is not in my life. And I think in so many ways I was sort of raging against that. And just saying, okay, if nobody cares about me, I'm not going to care about me either. And I was also trying to seek a cure in this demented, destructive way. And when I used heroin, it really did feel that way at first. It felt like the world, you know, the day my mom died was like the end of the world for me. And there was this new world without my mom in it, and I had to figure out how to be in it, and I didn't know how. And when I used heroin, it was like that world without my mom in it was okay, you know, at least it felt like that momentarily. But of course, as we all know, it actually only made things worse and harder. It made that world harder. So I was at that place. By then, about 3.5 years had gone past, and my mom was dead. And I really think in so many ways at that moment, I had realized, you know, that so much of that self-destruction was about how much I love my mom and how much I wanted to show everyone, this is how much I love my mom, I can't go on. And I had this, I reached this moment where I really had kind of reached the bottom of my despair, that I understood that that I'd made a vast, grand mistake, and that to honor my mom, I would really have needed to go on, to thrive. You know, I'm a mom now, and the last thing I want is my kids, should I die young, for my kids to honor me by failing to do what they're here to do and failing to be the people that I've raised them to be. So I was there at that place realizing this when there was a blizzard in Minnesota. Didn't you hear my Minnesota accent when I said Minnesota? I don't normally have it, but once in a while it comes out. And I went to REI. Do you all know what REI is? Oh, good. I went to REI to buy one of those cute little folding shovels that I thought I'd carry in my truck. I needed to dig my truck out. And I was waiting to buy the shovel, and there was this row of books nearby, and I just grabbed one to kill time. And, you know, a lot of books have changed my life, obviously. They've meant a lot to me, many different books. But this guidebook ended up being, by surprise, a book that really changed my life. And the guidebook was called The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. And I flipped it over. I'd never heard of the Pacific Crest Trail. How many of you learned of the Pacific Crest Trail through Wild? Wow. Yeah, I'm always amazed. It's this National Scenic Trail, this treasure that belongs to all of us, that was created by the people who came before us, this wilderness corridor that goes from Mexico to Canada through California, Oregon, and Washington up the crest of the Sierra Nevada and the Cascade Range. And so I read the back in that paragraph that told the brief story of that trail, that thing that happened, that true voice that spoke to me when I said, okay, Mom, you can go to college with me, spoke again, and it was just said, do this. I mean, it wasn't even necessarily a voice. It was frankly like, I think in Wild, I say it was like a blossoming in my chest. And I just, it was this big, amazing thing. And I was at this moment that I felt the smallest and the least amazing in my life. But I just felt instinctually that I needed to attach myself to something that was grand and beautiful. And so I got this idea to go hike. I knew that I couldn't afford to hike. It takes about 5.5 months to hike the entire trail. And I was paying off student loans. And, you know, on my 44th birthday this past September, I made my final student loan payment on my bachelor's degree. I did. That was my birthday present to myself. I paid that off. But so I was paying student loans, and I was, you know, didn't have enough money to take that long off work. But I knew I could scratch it together to take about 3 months off of work and save enough money to fund that kind of trip. And so I just decided to do it. I worked double shifts, and every week I'd go into REI with a wad of my waitressing cash and say, you know, I'm going to go hiking. What do you got for me? And REI has lots of great stuff. They love to sell it to you. And then, you know, I would always inevitably, you know, that camping stuff is so adorable, you know. And I'd be like, that looks necessary. And, you know, I took, it was like, you know, this saw, I'm a sucker for anything that folds up. You know, it's like, if there had been a kitchen sink that folded up, I would have taken it. But I bought, like, for example, a foldable saw, you know, just in case I wanted to cut down any trees while I was out there. And so you know that where this is going, right? So I bought all this stuff, and I closed down my life in Minnesota. My husband and I got divorced. I sold most of my stuff, which wasn't that much stuff to begin with. And I drove west, and I in the back of my truck, I had a 1979 Chevy Love pickup. And I filled the back with these boxes that I had prepared, full of dehydrated food and supplies, a $20 bill in each one, and addressed them to myself at these different stops along the way that I would go to on my hike. And I drove to Portland, Oregon, and left that stuff with a friend who would mail me the boxes. And then I got myself to the town of Mojave, California, which is in Southern California. It's a little town about 10 miles from a place where the PCT crosses a highway. And I checked into a motel and really looked at, piled all this stuff on the bed. And just really for the first time in a very deep, real, profound way, remembered that I'd never gone backpacking before. which was, you know, I knew it, but I tend to be somebody who, I'm an optimist, I'm an idealist, I'm a visionary, you know, and so I a lot of times the things I get into, I have like a sort of dreamy idea of it, and then the reality is always a lot different. I don't think I'm alone in that. And, you know, I was an avid day hiker, you know, that was really, I loved to hike, and I'd grown up in, you know, the woods. I was, and I'd sort of blurred this idea of the day hike and the wilderness backpacking trip. And let me tell you, they're two different things, you know? A hike, you wake up in your bed, you have brunch, you hike a few miles, and then you go to some place and have a cheeseburger and a glass of Chardonnay. Now, that's my kind of hike, right? Backpacking, there's no brunch on the PCT. And so, you know, I was starting to really think about this in a pretty realistic way when it was, you know, day one, and I was supposed to actually leave this motel room with all that crap on the bed. So here's what happened when once I got it all. I'm just going to read a little snippet. And the other thing is I had not thought about the specific, like, it didn't matter to me where I began my hike. I was thinking where I wanted to end my hike. And I knew that I could hike about 1,100 miles in 3 months. And so I just, you know, calculated the miles and went south down the map. And wherever my finger landed at about that mileage, that's where I would begin. And it was the Mojave Desert. And, you know, I'm from the land of 10,000 lakes. But it does turn out that there are hardly any lakes in the Mojave Desert. So, which means I had to carry water from day one, like really carry all my water, because it would take me a long time to get to the first water source. And so people are always asking me, well, how much should your pack weigh? And the one thing I didn't take on the trail was a scale. So I don't know, but it was super heavy, and it had at least 24 and a half pounds of water. I know that, in addition to everything else. So here's what happened. Finally, when everything I was going to carry was in the place that I needed to carry it, a hush came over me. I was ready to begin. I looked at my pack. It was at once enormous and compact, mildly adorable, and intimidatingly self-contained. It had an animate quality. In its company, I didn't feel entirely alone. Standing, it came up to my waist. I gripped it and bent to lift it. It wouldn't budge. I squatted and grasped its frame more robustly and tried to lift it again. Again, it didn't move, not even an inch. I tried to lift it with both hands, with my legs braced beneath me, while attempting to wrap it in a bear hug, with all of my breath and my might and my will, with everything in me, and still it would not come. It was exactly like attempting to lift a Volkswagen Beetle. It looked so cute, so ready to be lifted. And yet it was impossible to do. Do you guys do that? I walk by one of those folks, I'm like, I could lift that. I could totally lift that. You can't, it turns out. I sat down on the floor beside it and pondered my situation. How could I carry a backpack more than 1,000 miles over rugged mountains and waterless deserts if I couldn't even budget an inch in an air-conditioned motel room? The notion was preposterous, and yet I had to lift that pack. It hadn't occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to. I'd simply thought that if I added up all the things I needed in order to go backpacking, it would equal a weight that I could carry. The people at REI, it was true, had mentioned weight rather often in their soliloquies. But I hadn't paid attention. I thought about what I might take out of my pack, but each item struck me as either so obviously needed or so in case of emergency necessary that I didn't dare remove it. I would have to try to carry that pack as it was. I scooted over the carpet and situated myself on my rump right in front of my pack, wove my arms through the shoulder straps, and clipped the sternum strap across my chest. I took a deep breath and began rocking back and forth and back and forth to gain momentum, until finally I hurled myself forward with everything in me and got myself onto my hands and knees. My backpack was no longer on the floor. It was officially attached to me. It still seemed like a Volkswagen Beetle, only now it seemed like a Volkswagen Beetle that was parked on my back. I stayed there for a few moments, trying to get my balance. Slowly, I worked my feet beneath me while simultaneously scaling the metal cooling unit with my hands until I was vertical enough that I could do a deadlift. The frame of the pack squeaked as I rose, it too straining from the tremendous weight. By the time I was standing, which is to say, hunching in a remotely upright position, I was holding the vented metal panel that I'd accidentally ripped loose from the cooling unit. I couldn't even begin to reattach it. The place it needed to go was only inches out of my reach, but those inches were entirely out of the question. I propped the panel against the wall, buckled my hip belt, and staggered and swayed around the room, My center of gravity pulled in any direction I so much as leaned. The weight dug painfully into the tops of my shoulders, so I cinched my hip belt tighter and tighter still, trying to balance the burden, squeezing my middle so tightly that my flesh ballooned out on either side, which we all know is a fabulous look. My pack rose up like a mantle behind me, several inches above my head, and gripped me like a vice all the way down to my tailbone. It felt pretty awful, and yet perhaps this was how it felt to be a backpacker. I didn't know. I only knew that it was time to go. So I opened the door and stepped into the light. So there we go. There began my journey. Maybe I certainly felt like I was in over my head. And then everything that happened after that confirmed that feeling. I got onto the trail and, you know, it was just incredibly hard to walk because I was, you know, I was like, well, I can walk. Anyone can, you know, like I walk all the time. I'll just, and then I get out there and I'm carrying this really heavy pack that I honestly couldn't stand up. I am hunching. And everywhere, pretty quickly, I realized that the pack makes contact with me. It's chafing me. It's blistering me. It's my boots are problematic. I hadn't exactly been training for the hike. I'd been kind of up to all that stuff. I had still been up to until very recently. It was really one of those experiences where I understood that I was, in deep. It was also those first days, so I'm in pain, I'm in physical pain, and as the days went by, things started to happen, like, you know, honestly, all the skin off the back of my, on my tailbone, where the pack was on my tailbone, was just gone. It just was an open wound, and my feet were terribly blistered, and also, you know, I didn't see another person, I didn't encounter another human being for the first 8 days of my hike, so that was really profound. I had never done that. I loved being alone. I was a writer by then, and I loved nothing more than to, you know, be in some little cabin writing all day. But it was a different thing. I'd never gone even a couple days without seeing another human being. And suddenly I'm out there by myself, thinking the things one thinks in mountainous, deserty places, like, oh my God, the mountain lions are going to come and eat me. But also pushing that away. A lot of times people say, well, weren't you afraid? And those of you who read the book know that I became incredibly determined. I'll read this quick paragraph about what I did about fear, because it was, because it would have been impossible to do my hike if I had let myself be afraid. It was a deal I'd made with myself months before, and the only thing that allowed me to hike alone. I knew that if I allowed fear to overtake me, my journey was doomed. Fear, to a great extent, is born of a story we tell ourselves. And so I chose to tell myself a different story from the one women are told. I decided I was safe. I was strong. I was brave. Nothing could vanquish me. Insisting on this story was a form of mind control, but for the most part, it worked. Every time I heard a sound of unknown origin or felt something horrible cohering in my imagination, I pushed it away. I simply did not let myself become afraid. Fear begets fear. Power begets power. I willed myself to beget power. And it wasn't long before I actually wasn't afraid. I was working too hard to be afraid. And so, I didn't prepare physically, but I prepared mentally. And I think that was what allowed me actually to endure the physical stuff, is I went out there really prepared to do this thing. And I think that rose out of just a great sense of that thing being the only thing I really had to hold on to anymore. That it was the one thing I had to do because I said I was going to do it. And so I was really determined about it. And I had all kinds of experiences that you know, people often say, well, what was the epiphany on the trail? What was the big aha moment? And there wasn't one. You know, there were many that were obviously important moments, important experiences. But the most important aha, I think, was really the accumulation of all of those hard days. You know, the simplicity of continuing to hike even if your feet are killing you, or continuing to forge ahead even when you're miserable and it's hot or it's cold, or any number of things that y'all who read the book know happen, was just keeping faith with that simple act of getting through each day, and sometimes getting through each step or each mile. And so that became the thing, the grand thing that made this journey worthwhile. You know, I went out there with a sort of Hollywood vision that I was seeking spiritual redemption or emotional healing. And I think that I kind of imagined that being, I didn't think about the physical. I thought about all the times I would look at that beautiful wild landscape, which I did do, and reflect upon my life, which I did do. But the thing was that I was taken out of those moments. I was taken out of my head and into my body. And my days were not really spent terribly reflectively, especially at first. They were spent thinking things like, where the hell is the next water source, you know? Or, you know, craving madly a cheeseburger or a Snapple lemonade, as those of you know who read the book. But, you know, I really was in the physical. And it wasn't until I was really out there that I understood that it was exactly what I needed, is to have that, you know, physical enactment of my suffering. You know, here I was emotionally suffering, and to go and physically suffer, it did something. It gave me some perspective about emotional suffering. And so I did, you know, that sort of, I had that experience, and it was years later that I decided to write about it. I finished my trip September 15th, 1995, and one of the questions I am often asked is, why did you wait so long to write Wild? And the answer is I didn't wait. I wrote Wild the moment that I felt like I had something to say about it. The art and craft of memoir doesn't really hinge on look at me, I did this big thing. There are a lot of people who have hiked further and better and faster and more adventurous and done all kinds of things that were bigger than what I did. The point of Wild isn't like, wow, I hiked 1,100 miles. The point of Wild is I had this experience in which I hiked 1,100 miles, and it was life-altering. It was transformative to me. And so until I really understood what it was and how I could articulate it, until also I had developed as a writer and apprenticed myself to the writer's craft and learned how to write the kind of book that Wild is, I wasn't ready to tell it. And it was really that scene I read to you of, you know, in 2008, I started poking around. I thought I would write an essay about my experience. I thought I had about 20 or 30 pages to say. And I started writing, and one of the first things I wrote was this scene that I just read to you, this of me being in the motel room with that heavy, you know, pack, that impossible pack, which is, you know, a comic scene at root. But when I wrote it, I understood too, and I laugh at that scene, I understood too that it was actually, kind of a core scene in the book when it came to my reason for writing it and what Wild is actually about, which is bearing the unbearable. You know, I felt really, truly sure that I couldn't bear the world without my mom. I couldn't bear having to live the rest of my life without my mom. I couldn't bear the things that I had done, the things I had regretted, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And I had to figure out a way to do it. And so when I wrote that scene where there I was, the younger version of me, alone in a hotel, in a motel room, wrestling with that weight that I couldn't bear, I understood that this was what the book was about. And it was also the conduit through which I could tell a story that was about me. You know, a memoir is always getting this bad rap for being the narcissistic form. Like, who would write a memoir except somebody who's self-absorbed? But really, nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I think that when done well, memoir is the impulse to simply use the self to tell a story that actually has some meaning to other people, that other people see themselves reflected in the story, that does the kind of grand reach that literature does, which is to try to illuminate the human condition, to say, what does it mean to be human? Who are we really? And so when I saw that, like, that I thought I could try to do that in Wild, And so that's how the book was born. I wrote the first draft of Wild from like 2008 to, I finished it in February 2010. And by then I had sold it to Knopf, my publisher. And I sent it off to my editor. And those of you who are in the room who are writers know that there's this glorious moment in the writer's life where you've finished that draft that is as good as you can get it by yourself, and you send it to the editor, and you know you're going to get back a long letter saying, it's great, but you know, here's all this stuff that you should revise and reconsider and edit, you know, that you've still got a bunch of work ahead of you. But I was sort of in that glorious moment that I thought, well, there has to be one author in the world who gets a reply from their editor that says, it's brilliant, it's perfect. So I was thinking, maybe it's just done, you know. And into my email box pops an email from my friend, the writer Steve Almond. And he said, Cheryl, I have been writing an advice column called Dear Sugar, writing it anonymously for this website called The Rumpus. And it doesn't really have a following, and I'm not interested in doing it, and it doesn't pay anything. Would you like to take it over? And since that had described essentially my entire writing career until that point, I was like, sure. So I, in this moment of, you know, really finishing Wild but still needing to work on it, I took on this other thing, this Dear Sugar advice column. And I at first thought it would be kind of a lark, and I would be just funny and flip off answers, you know, really in glib and snarky ways. I don't know why I thought that. I had never in my whole life managed to be anything but utterly sincere. I am not a glib and snarky writer, sadly. I like glib and snarky writers, but I aspire to be them, but I'm not that person. And also, I never had even taken like psychology 101. I had never gone through therapy except those couple sessions that I describe in Wild. And I wasn't even a connoisseur of the advice column form. And so I was anxious about this, but I also then began to think really deeply, well, what is it? You know, what does this job, this gig require? And I realized that what it required was essentially everything I had been doing as a writer. And that is that asking those big questions. What does it mean to be human? You know, my first book is a novel called Torch. In order to create those characters, you know, I have to really imagine, like, what would it be like to be in this situation? What would it feel like to have this, to be born into this body with this identity? And the same with Wild, you know, even though it's a story about me, I had to really work hard to, you know, make myself really transparent to you on the page. I think most of you would agree who've read the book, I'm pretty vulnerable there. I've opened myself to the reader on the page. And so, you know, this is all the work I'd done all my life as a writer. And what I got was to apply it to these letters that people were writing me, anonymous people, not just 20-somethings asking about sex and love, though there was that batch, but, you know, middle-aged people, older people, both genders, anything from money to relationships to dysfunctional families to terrible children to, you know, all these things. And I also just decided not to stick to the form of the advice column, that I decided I would write with the full force of my humanity and the full force of everything I knew as a writer. And so they're really more essays than they are, you know, advice columns, but with the prompt that are, you know, real letters from real people. So it grew a cult following online, and people started to figure out who I was. Anyone who'd read my work was emailing me and saying, you have to be Sugar. Because in a lot of these columns, I tell stories from my life. So they were starting to recognize me. And so a month before Wild came out, I flew to San Francisco and revealed my identity as Sugar. Came out. If you're going to come out, do it in San Francisco. And so I thought I'd just end tonight before I open it up for questions. I'd love to hear answer any questions you all have. I thought I'd just read one of the shorter columns in the book. It's the title column, Tiny Beautiful Things. And this one is about... you know, it is addressed to a 20-something, you'll see. But it gives you a taste of what the Sugar thing is all about. How many of you in here are familiar with the Dear Sugar column? Just some of you? Okay. Oh, a lot of you. Thank you. Sweet peas. Okay. Sugar calls her people sweet peas. Yeah, so. Dear Sugar, I read your column religiously. I'm 22. From what I can tell by your writing, you're in your early 40s. My question is short and sweet. What would you tell your 20-something self if you could talk to her now? Love, seeking wisdom. Dear seeking wisdom, stop worrying about whether you're fat. You're not fat. Or rather, you're sometimes a little bit fat, but who gives a shit? There is nothing more boring and fruitless than a woman lamenting the fact that her stomach is round. Feed yourself, literally. The sort of people worthy of your love will love you more for this, sweet pea. In the middle of the night, in the middle of your 20s, when your best woman friend crawls naked into your bed, straddles you, and says, "You should run away from me before I devour you," believe her. So you guys have had that friend too, huh? Yeah. You are not a terrible person for wanting to break up with someone you love. You don't need a reason to leave. Wanting to leave is enough. Leaving doesn't mean you're incapable of real love or that you'll never love anyone else again. It doesn't mean you're morally bankrupt or psychologically demented or a nymphomaniac. It means you wish to change the terms of one particular relationship. That's all. Be brave enough to break your own heart. When that really sweet but fucked up gay couple invites you over to their cool apartment to do ecstasy with them, say no. There are some things you can't understand yet. Your life will be a great and continuous unfolding. It's good you've worked hard to resolve childhood issues while you're in your 20s, but understand that what you resolve will need to be resolved again and again. You will come to know things that can only be known with the wisdom of age and the grace of years. Most of those things will have to do with forgiveness. One evening, you will be rolling around on the wooden floor of your apartment with a man who will tell you he doesn't have a condom. You will smile in this spunky way that you think is hot and tell him to go ahead anyway. This will be a mistake for which you alone will pay. Don't lament so much about how your career is going to turn out. You don't have a career. You have a life. Do the work. Keep the faith. Be true blue. You're a writer because you write. Keep writing and quit your bitching. Your book has a birthday. You don't know what it is yet. You cannot convince people to love you. This is an absolute rule. No one will ever give you love because you want him or her to give it. Real love moves freely in both directions. Don't waste your time on anything else. Most things will be okay eventually, but not everything will be. Sometimes you'll put up a good fight and lose. Sometimes you'll hold on really hard and realize there is no choice but to let go. Acceptance is a small, quiet room. One hot afternoon during the era in which you've gotten yourself ridiculously tangled up with heroin, you'll be riding the bus and thinking what a worthless piece of crap you are when a little girl will get on the bus holding the strings of two purple balloons. She'll offer you one of the balloons, but you won't take it because you believe you no longer have a right to such tiny, beautiful things. You're wrong. You do. Your assumptions about the lives of others are in direct relation to your naive pomposity. Many people you believe to be rich are not rich. Many people you think have it easy worked hard for what they got. Many people who seem to be gliding right along have suffered and are suffering. Many people who appear to you to be old and stupidly saddled down with kids and cars and houses were once every bit as hip and pompous as you. When you meet a man in the doorway of a Mexican restaurant who later kisses you while explaining that this kiss doesn't mean anything because much as he likes you, he's not interested in having a relationship with you or anyone right now, just laugh and kiss him back. Your daughter will have his sense of humor. Your son will have his eyes. The useless days will add up to something. The shitty waitressing jobs, the writing in your journal, the long meandering walks, the hours reading poetry and story collections and novels and dead people's diaries, and wondering about sex and God and whether you should shave under your arms or not. These things are your becoming. One Christmas, at the very beginning of your 20s, when your mother gives you a warm coat that she saved for months to buy. Don't look at her skeptically after she tells you she thought the coat was perfect for you. Don't hold it up and say it's longer than you like your coats to be and too puffy and possibly even too warm. Your mother will be dead by spring. That coat will be the last gift she gave you. You will regret the small thing you didn't say for the rest of your life. Say thank you, sugar. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, how about some questions from the audience? Back there, yes. Can you holler it out? So the question is, on my hike, of course, I met a lot of other hikers, and why didn't I ever want to hike with other people? I did sometimes hike with them, and usually, well, first of all, one of the things, it's kind of like running, and sometimes you can, like, run with someone, but, you know, to have the right kind of running partner, you really have to run at the same pace, you know? And hiking is hard enough, too, where, you know, you kind of have to go at your own pace. And it's tricky to be, like, with someone. And one thing that all the couples I met, the male and female pairs, there was always a conflict between them, you know, like, all summer long. And it was because always the men wanted to hike faster and felt that they were being kind of held back by the women, and the women resented that they were always feeling pressured, you know, and I was so glad not to have that problem. Every one of them had that problem. But also, so there was that, and I did sometimes hike with them, but we would, you know, hike together for an hour and chat, and then we would maybe meet up at a certain camp spot and camp together. But I was really out there to be alone. So sometimes I would spend a few nights in a row with a group of other hikers. But then I would either hang back or get ahead of them because I was out there to be alone. And one of the things that was important to me about that is, you know, when you're alone, you have to rely on yourself for everything. And that, I think, was a really important piece of the experience for me. I mean, it was so fun to camp with the other hikers, and believe me, I did it and I enjoyed it. But I would even find myself just, you know, there was just more of a collective sense of ease, you know? And I didn't want ease. I wanted to be alone and to feel my own strength and to test my own strength. So I did that, yeah. Yeah, getting out of my comfort zone was really a key piece of it, yeah. Anyone over here? Yes, in the back. Did my feet recover? The feet question is the number one question I've been asked. And, you know, I should just come barefoot on stage every night. My feet did recover. It did take a few years for my toenails to grow back. Because, it, you know, especially I lost the big toenails. It was a big deal. But they did eventually grow back, and they're restored to their, you know, as close as a 44-year-old woman can get to their original beauty. So, and the other, so that's the number one question. The second most common question is about, like, the people in the book. You know, is my brother and sister and my stepfather? And, you know, we never, everyone's fine with the book. My brother especially was, you know, really moved by the book. And when he read it, we had a deep, important conversation. And we never did come back together as a family in the way that we were when I grew up. We never did. But I love my siblings, and you know, it's been hard. It's been hard for them, actually. Life has been. So it hasn't been an easy thing to do things like Christmases together. Yeah. Yes. Okay, the question is about the film. So your hometown girl, Reese Witherspoon, read the book a few months before it was published. She was the first person we took it to in Hollywood when like we first started to think, well, maybe, you know, if somebody wants the film rights. And so, like, the day we took it to this new, my film agent, she said, you know, Reese would love to read it over the weekend. What do you, you know, do you, is that okay? And I said, sure. And then I proceeded to, and I'm not like a very, you know, woo-woo mystical person, but I do have my certain beliefs. And so I lit a candle, and every time I let the candle burn, every time I would pass it, I would say, Reese. And and then on Monday morning, Reese called me. And so it worked, you know. And she loved the book and really connected with the book. And we had this long conversation about everything about it. And I could see that she really, you know, that this was a passion, like a passion project for her. Like she really wanted to be the person to bring this to the screen. And so she is, and she's going to star in it playing me. And I didn't want anything to do with the script. You know, this is my work of art. I am a writer of memoir and novels and essays and short stories. I'm not a screenwriter. And I also just think that, you know, that there's something about, like, the film, you know, has to be its own thing. And in some ways, you know, and also they wanted to do it so quickly that I've just been so busy this past year. So she hired Nick Hornby to write the script. Nick Hornby, who's a fantastic writer. And I went to England in January, where, you know, Wild came out in the UK, and got to hang out with Nick for a few days and talk to him all about everything. And I've read the script. It's really good. And so it's in the works. And anything, I mean, who knows what happens in the weird world of Hollywood, but, you know, they're trying to have it happen, like, this summer. But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see. I mean, to shoot it this summer. But I you don't count any anything until any chickens till they're hatched, you know. So we'll see. Yes. When did I realize that it was going from an essay to a book? You know, I'm in a writer's group in Portland, and what happened is I started bringing these pages, and it just kept getting longer, and like it was like 80 pages, and we still hadn't gotten on the trail yet, you know. And my writer's group was like, Cheryl, are you in, like, this is a book. And I was like, it's not a book. And then I conceded that it was going to be a section of a book. Like it was going to be, and it was, I had all these funny, it's funny that I couldn't see it, you know. And then finally, after I got to about page 100, I was like, okay, maybe this is a book. But it was through writing. That's how I, like people always ask, well, what are you going to write next? And I don't know. You know, I've been doing so much publicity for Wild and Tiny Beautiful Things and just traveling the country. I haven't been writing a lot. But when I do sit down to write, I'm going to let the writing show me what's next. Maybe it will be another novel. Maybe it will be another memoir. It'll be one of those things. Yeah. Back there. Yeah, so Torch is the book. There are pieces in Wild where I say I was writing a book in my head as I hiked. And Torch was the book. You know, Torch was that, I think every writer has that first book that they just absolutely have to write. It is like it's in their bones, and they have to, you know, they can't live until it's out. And it's very fictional, but because it also has hugely autobiographical strands, or sort of the premise is autobiographical, a lot of people read it as if it's nonfiction. But, you know, they really are characters. But the situation is that a young woman in chapter one finds out that she's going to die of cancer, and she's going to die quick. And so the way that character dies is really similar to the way my mom died. Like the character of the mother is the least fictionalized character in Torch by a long stretch. And when I was writing Torch, I had no intention of, I didn't know I would ever write a memoir, you know. So I was just doing what a lot of novelists do, is taking whatever I wanted from life and then casting it into the world of imagination. But also because I write realism, a lot of people really, those characters seem like real people. And so many, there's a young woman character in Torch named Claire. And after Torch came out, so many of my friends would say things like, I didn't know you had an affair with an older man in the hospital when your mom was dying. And I was like, I didn't. That was Claire. You know, she's a fictional character. And I was like, it really is fiction. But yeah, when you read it, what you'll see is there are certain scenes that you will see echoes. In some cases, like the scene where I'm not with my mother when she dies, and it's because of my brother. You know, that's in Torch. It's also in Wild. And, you know, and in Torch, I didn't have any allegiance to what really happened, but you'll see that I stuck pretty close to the truth on that one. And then in Wild, I, you know, it was like I revisited it again because it's what actually happened, you know. So I think that as you read on, though, when you get deeper into Torch, you'll see, too, in that book, I was really interested, too, exploring, like, grief for the family system. You know, whereas Wild is my story. Torch is the story of this family and really the community. The character of my mother was a community radio show host, which my mother wasn't. But you know, the impact of a death of an ordinary woman on a community was kind of my interest in Torch. Thank you for reading it. I love when people love my first baby. That it's fiction. Yeah, and she isn't. I mean, really, we have some things in common, but yeah, she's not. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Yeah, I get asked about that a lot, and you know, I've always thought, well, I can't think of any other way to write than to just go all the way, you know, just to go all the way there and tell the biggest, deepest truth I can possibly tell, you know, and it's scary, and you know, before Wild came out, I was absolutely terrified, and it's still because it is. It's like, if you don't like Wild, and there are a whole bunch of people who don't like Wild, trust me, I am aware of that. You know, it's hard because it's like, well, that character is me. And sometimes I've had a couple. This one woman came to one of my events, and people say the funniest things. She, as I was signing her book, she said, "I'm so glad I came because I hated you, but now I like you. When I saw you in person, I liked you." And I was just like, oh, thanks, I guess. But that's the feeling, is it's like people either like you or don't like you, you know, based on your book. And so that was a terrifying prospect. With fiction too, trust me, if you get a bad review, it hurts. But there's something about your memoir getting a bad review that it's hard not to, I mean, you have to just really distance yourself from that conversation. Or you can't go on, you know, because it's hurtful. But, you know, so I was afraid of that, and yet I felt like, well, I'm not going to protect myself, you know. Writing is not about protecting yourself. It's about, and I don't mean confession. I mean telling the truth of what it means to be human. And so I had to show you everything that I was and that I felt and that I experienced and that I did, whether they were like good things or bad things, or, you know, it's not that there was good or bad. It's like human. I know all of you in this room have done something that you, that's not the best thing, you know? And we all do all the time. And you've also done something that is the best thing, you know? And so for me as a writer, I feel like, well, how do I show the greatest amount of that as possible? You know, that's my job. So thank you for seeing that. Yes, the truth that lives there. Now, the funniest thing about the Tiny Beautiful Things book is so many people come to me and say, oh my gosh, you know, that book completely changed my life. It was responsible for, you know, this big decision in my life. And I always know, like 80% of the time, what they're gonna say is, you know, they got divorced or they left there. And I'm like, I'm such a homewrecker, you know? And I realized that, I mean, at first I was laughing. I was like, please don't tell me, you know, like I helped end your marriage, you know. But really what that's about is essentially that place, and the way I wrote that essay, what it is three different letters. Actually, I had 300 different letters, but I chose three, and it was all the same situation. I am with this person who I love and absolutely love, and I don't have any reason to not want to stay in this, but I don't want to stay in this. I'm not in love, and yet I can't, and so, you know, should I stay or should I go? And what I say, you know, because I was in that situation in my first marriage, where I say, you know, the thing is you ultimately have to, you know, find a way to listen to that inner voice, you know. So all of those people who left because they read that column, they were teetering on the edge, and I just said, I said, it's okay. Like, you'll be okay on the other end. And also, this other person who you're with will be okay, because you're not doing that person any favors by staying with them if you don't want to be with them, you know. And so I was really surprised by how many people are in that situation, because that column, I wouldn't say it's one of, you know, just in terms of the kind of my judgment as a writer, you know, like the like I think it's fine, but I wouldn't put it in the top 10 of the best columns if I had to rank them. But it is way up there when it comes to influence on other people, which is really kind of fascinating to me. Yeah, so thank you for your thoughts. Maybe one or two more questions over there, you guys? One, yeah. No, you know, I really, so much of what I came to understand on the trail about the wounds were that they were never going to heal in this way that maybe I had expected them to. And part of my ability to go on was learning this, the art of acceptance. And on the trail, that was demanded of me. You know, accepting that you're going to be walking along and your feet are killing you because they're covered with blisters or whatever. And just accepting that, like, in the moment kind of thing. And it really gave way to a sense of a shift in understanding about things like my grief, that, you know, it was never going to be okay that my mom was dead. It wasn't like I was going to reach this moment where it's like, oh, it's fine that she's dead. It's still not fine. You know, I wish my mom were here now, you know, but she's not. And so to just accept that, very simple idea, really, really profoundly hard thing to do. Like, so many of those things are that seem the simplest are the hardest, you know. And so I think that it wasn't like I finished my hike and then I went back in time. I was always going forward. Now, that doesn't mean I was like the Buddha, you know, and then everything was good and everything, you know, but certainly my life, yeah, headed in directions that were great. You know, 9 days after my hike, I met the man who is now my husband. And in so many ways, like, you know, I met him at that right moment when I was like open to. And there again, it wasn't like we dated 4 years before we got married, and we both had things we still had to work out, you know. I still have things I have to work out, you know, we all do. But it set me on this course. Now, I did definitely wish sometimes that I could go back, you know, and like hike another long trail, and because it was such a great experience, and life just hasn't offered that yet. But my husband and I would really love to do the whole trail with our kids when they're a little bit older. We're thinking they're 7 and 8. My son's going to be 9 in a couple weeks, and we keep thinking that there's going to be this magic hour where they're like old enough that they can carry packs, but not so old that they're surly teenagers, you know. So I think there's going to be like 15 minutes in there that. So we're going to try to shoot that. And there was a question back there. Are you calling a cheeseburger frivolous? I think not. Yeah, you know, are you a therapist? I need help, actually. This is a question I'm asking myself. I mean, because people ask me all the time, and first of all, I can say that, you know, just on the personal level, like the me inside of my life, I don't feel any different. You know, I feel grounded exactly in who I am, and, you know, my identity as a writer and the mother of my children and all, like, those things are really just unchanged, you know, that's who I am. But you're right that, you know, my life has gone through this really strange transition in this last year, where suddenly, you know, the tiny bit of fame that writers do have, like, I have that right now. And one of the things that happens is people project onto you their ideas of what that means. Just we project onto famous people, you know, and so that's been a funny kind of thing for me, and to have to figure out, well, like, how do I navigate just essentially the sort of rocket ship ride I've been on? And, you know, I sort of jokingly asked if you were a therapist, but I said to my husband, you know, I've been traveling so much and I've been promoting, and things are going to kind of quiet down this summer, and I said we should go to therapy together. You know, just to talk about everything that's changed in our lives. Because our family is still the same, but suddenly, you know, just lots of things have shifted. And I don't want to lose our, I don't want to, I want to do this right. You know, I want our family to stay safe in that storm, you know. And so, yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out. It's a great question, and I don't know the answer. We'll see. One more question, maybe, huh? Is that right? Yes. Over there? Or two more questions. Yep. Somebody was upset over here. Yes. However many questions. What do we? Yes. Okay. You know, it's the sweetest thing. So my son, who's about to turn 9, a few weeks ago, he said, Mom, I want to start keeping a journal. And both my kids are just avid readers, and they've always been, obviously, they've been surrounded by books all their lives, and reading is a big part of our life. But my son has started this journal, and it's so cool because we don't tell him, like, go write in your journal now. Like every night before bed, he says, you know, I have to write in my journal. And he goes into his, we have a art room in our house. And it's just where all their art stuff is. And he goes and he writes in his journal. And he's adamant, like, you know, don't read my journal. So I begged him desperately that he would just at least show me, like, one entry, you know. And it's amazing and adorable. And he's, like, he's journaling. He's reflecting. He reports what happened. He reflects on it. He says, like, one of the things, one of the funniest things too, that, like, my kids are trying to absorb this. When this all started happening, they didn't know what fame was. They had never had that word defined for them. And so my kids were trying to figure this out. And so they'd be like, are you as famous as Lady Gaga? You know? And I was like, no. And also, so one day at school last spring, he's in this art class, and they had to do like a sort of graphic novel sort of thing where they had to do like six panels, and each panel had to be a drawing of something that happened to them at school. And what my son did was he drew six different scenarios where he is talking to a faculty or staff member at the school, and what each of them is saying is, I read about your mom in the newspaper. And I realized that was really fascinating to me, because that was, so now he's, grown-ups are stopping him in the hallway, and my daughter, the parents of their friends, and oh, and they say things to them about me, which it was really interesting for the kids, because kids are really sort of, they want it to be about them, you know, so I've had to really, like, sort of, you know, my son was like, when will you stop being famous, because I'm tired of it. And I understand they're tired of it, because I'm theirs. Yeah, yeah. Maybe one or two more questions there. So who went, damn, when I, okay, you. If you curse, you get called on. Oh, thank you. She said, thanks for all the thousands of dollars I've saved her in therapy. Yeah. Did my mom leave any writings or anything? I have her college papers, and that's really cool. Some of those papers are accounts of her life. My mom, you know, had, she was a battered woman, and she wrote about that. In one of her papers that I found. And we had talked about that in our life, but it was really interesting to read it just through my mother's perspective, because my mother had always been really protective, not wanting to say bad things about my father to me and my siblings. So in this paper, she really wrote about it, which was really something. And my mother was a great gardener and a great seamstress, and she grew a lot of our own food and made a lot of our own clothes. And so the best things from my mother were her calendars. And so she would write, you know, put the tomatoes in. I mean, she just chronicled the garden and sometimes the projects that she was sewing on the calendar, you know, how people would just write a word or two. And that's really nice to have. So listen, we could go on and on, but I'll be signing books. And if you have something you're desperate to say to me, you can say it to me then. I'm afraid, what I fear is, you know, that they have that hook. They told me they have a big hook. They'll drag me off the stage if I don't end. Thank you so much.